This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 289 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and co-hosting with me, first off, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. Hello, everyone. I got to do my impression of Peter yesterday with an Across the Pond segment for our extended brethren. So, had a good time this weekend, and hopefully everyone will look forward to hearing me as a guest, which is kind of frightening.
You're going to be on extended, huh?
I am. I was officially the guest or guest host, but you know, there's nothing worse than talking about yourself as the guest. I'd still rather be the one asking the questions, not receiving them.
Well, speaking of, you know, talking about yourself, we do have Rob Mark with us also, who is not shy about talking about himself. Hey, Rob.
Hi.
Touche.
Yeah, very nice good job, Rob. Nice job.
You know, it's not the same as when, remember that other guy we used to have on the show, the young kid that was the airline geek? I can't remember his name, but you know, he always had such a way of jumping into the start of the show that made it fun, and without him it's just different. And
it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah. What was his name again? Ralph?
Fred? Dan?
Unicorns and Rainbows.
Dan's not here. Yeah, oh, right. Unicorn. Wait till there's a unicorn airline. Hi, I'm Dan Webb, and I'm the CEO of Unicorn Airline.
All right. Well, why don't we... You know who else is not here this episode? Is our guest.
Tell anybody who the hell he is.
No, we won't. We won't embarrass him. No, but we did have a guest scheduled, a great guest scheduled, and sort of at the last minute, unable to make it for good reasons. So this is going to be a little bit different episode without a guest. It'll be just us guys, and we'll see how that works out. Also, David, no airplane of the week this time, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. Committing podcast with extended and and the day-to-day job ruining my day to work on my history segment. I thought about saying, since this is coming out on Wednesday and Wednesday is the beginning of Lent, I was giving up writing history segments for Lent, but I don't think that'll go over very well.
No,
unless everybody else wants to volunteer to do it. But So this week we're taking a break, and next week we will get back to writing in the polar vortex like we are here.
Very good.
Hey, all right. I like where you were going there for a minute, David, with the polar vortex.
Vortex.
I do have an aviation minute today, Max. So you'll
that's
be
good.
Happy
that's good.
That.
So we do have some content.
Yes, yes. It's only 90 seconds, but hey, you got to start somewhere.
You know what my greatest fear is about this episode?
That it's just about over?
No, although it may be. Is that without a guest? See, I think the guest kind of keeps us, you know, in check, and we want to behave ourselves when we have a guest with us. And since we don't, I'm concerned that we might get a little crazy this time. So we'll just have to watch that.
It's Airplane Geeks Unplugged.
Unplugged.
I like that. That's kind of cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, we do have some aviation news we're going to talk about. We have that. We have an Australia desk report from Steve and Grant. The RAF, the RAAF celebration of 100 years of military aviation just occurred. And
yay.
Yeah. Those guys hung out at the event, and they're going to tell us about the JSF mock-up they spent some time in, some other good interviews they conducted. And so we'll look forward to that. We have Rob's Aviation Minute, as he mentioned, And we have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment, and Peter continues his look at aviation developments in the Middle East. And then we have some listener mail. We've been receiving, guys, you've seen this. We have been receiving a lot of listener mail lately. You know, it kind of comes and goes in waves. Actually, mostly it just kind of comes. But that sounds wrong. But I may have to take that out. Well, we do have a lot of listener mail, and we'll try to get to a bunch of that this episode. So, all right, I think we can get started with the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready.
Our first story comes from strategypage.com. This is female pilots sharply reduce helicopter losses. That's kind of an intriguing title. According to this article, 10% of Army helicopter pilots are women, but 3% of helicopter accidents occur when the pilot is a woman. Interesting. So, why do you think that is?
Ego.
I think women are just better pilots than men.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are, actually. I mean, and everybody that says that women can do some things better than men and men can do some things better than women, blah, blah, blah. Women don't get as hung up, and as I said, they don't get their ego wrapped up in, let's see how far we can push this, like guys do. And I'm not saying all of the accidents are like that, but it's amazing how many, and of course helicopters have proportionally way more accidents and incidents than fixed-wing airplanes do.
Hmm.
Again, I think it's important that they. I'm actually more surprised that someone even took the time to measure this. But it's pretty cool
because it seems obvious, right?
Well, no, not just that, but it's almost one of those things that you. I guess when I read it, it just didn't even occur to me that someone would even think to say, "I wonder if the women are better pilots than the men."
Hmm.
I wonder if that holds true on fixed wing airplanes.
Yeah, and you know, I remember several times, Rob, that you have mentioned the difference between your student pilots, the way that, I mean, you know, you don't want to stereotype, but in general that you've seen some differences in the way women approach the task of learning how to fly versus men.
That's right, and it's very much the same kind of thing. The women would just take the learning experience for what it was, fix the problem and move on.
Yeah.
Where sometimes the guys would obsess about it, or they would go overboard trying to fix it. And it's just different, I guess. The testosterone versus what's
that other
hormones?
Stuff?
What's the
estrogen?
Estrogen. Thank you. Like I said,
oh, God,
the difference between testosterone and estrogen. That's the answer right there.
Well, you know, as I was reading this, I found myself wondering what are the statistics look like in the for the airlines? How does the accident rate or the incident rate for commercial airlines look for male pilots versus female pilots? And I didn't find anything, but I did find something about general aviation, and it's not new. It's from 2001, and it's a Johns Hopkins study. And this study found that, and I quote from the study, air crashes involving female pilots are mostly due to mishandling of the plane, while those with male pilots are more often due to flawed decision-making and inattention. I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, this is an old survey, and I didn't really dive into it too deeply, but I thought that was kind of an interesting distinction.
That is interesting. And, of course, again, I these days, we've had so few airline mishaps in this part of the world that we almost don't have any data to even look at. Now, of course, if we could measure incidents, it might be, you know, that might give us something, but we don't really even have that.
The professor, Susan Baker, who was the study's co-author, said that males trade accuracy for speed. They would rather do something faster, even if they don't do it accurately. and that women tend to be more cautious and pay greater attention to details and rules. I mean, it feels kind of right.
It does, actually. I was just having this kind of a discussion with Nancy before I came in to do this session. We were talking about almost exactly
Wait a minute,
that
hold
kind
on.
Of thing.
Did you actually just say when you were talking about this with Nancy during your session?
I wasn't on the couch or anything, but I consider the dinner table in the evening to be kind of my session. You know? Except I don't pay her when I'm done.
I'm not sure if this is a good idea or not, Rob.
You mean that I don't pay her?
No, the first part of that.
Oh.
All right. Well, listen, let's move on to our next story. This is from aviationhumor.net. She lives in a Boeing 727. Now, this was submitted by someone that, Rob, you know this person, don't you?
Yes, this was my daughter out in school in Southern California, and she found this and thought, Dad, if you weren't married, this would be you, she told me. So I had to open that and to watch how this lady took a 727. I wasn't so keen on the wood paneling on the inside, but I don't know what you guys thought of it. Interesting place to live, though.
Yeah, and this aircraft, the 727, it says that she bought this for $2,000. That was it. And she said it cost $4,000 to move it, and then she spent $24,000 to renovate it. So for $30,000, she's got this great home. Well,
that's
I say
right.
Great, but, I mean, who else lives in a Boeing 727? A few people, but not too many.
Yeah, and that's why I thought, hey, listen, if they could do some of that. If you've ever been to the campus there at the University of Southern California at L.A., and they have the is it the Endeavor, I think, that's there, David? Is that the shuttle that went to L.A.?
Oh, at the Science Museum?
Yeah. I think it's the Endeavor.
Yes, the Endeavor.
And it's inside the building, and right outside the building is an old United DC-8 on a stick. It looks like someone's big model airplane. And I remember saying something to her when we first went to the campus. I said, you know, that could be a pretty cool place to live. You know, you can kind of see what's going on from up there. You've got a lot of room. And I think she must have taken that to heart. Maybe I should buy one and just have it installed in the backyard when she comes home.
I think that'd be cool.
Yeah.
So this is interesting, Rob, because your daughter suggested a story for you on this podcast.
Yes.
And as David knows, my wife has actually suggested two stories that we've used on the UAV Digest. And I'm feeling like this is like we've reached some significant milestone here because, you know, I don't know about your guys' families, but on my side, usually like none of them care anything about this airplane stuff. And now they're submitting, you know, or they're getting engaged and giving us articles. I think that's great.
I think they just want to take over.
Well, I mean, there is the running joke that we have in our household. One of our original stories was the fact that on UAV Digest was that the gentleman that was using a quadcopter to chase the Canadian geese off of a beach in Montreal. And as we arrive at the university that Michelle works at, usually the whole area is filled with Canada geese. And she looks around and she says the school needs a quadcopter. So, yeah, it's definitely we're sort of rubbing off on the ladies in our life. And that I don't know if that's good, bad, or, well, they stick with us and they've put up with us doing this for 4 years. I guess it had to happen.
I wonder if this is happening to our listeners as well. You know, maybe what we should do is do this. We get, obviously, a lot of listeners who send in links to news items and other interesting aviation-related stuff. Maybe we should have, like, 1 week where we say that any links that you all send in to us have to be from your spouse, your kids, somebody in your family. Not you, but the non-aviation fanatics, the non-av geeks. What do you think about that? Think that would work? Who knows what
we would
get? I
think that works.
Yeah, you know what we'll end up with, don't you?
What?
The airplane geek's recipe of the week.
Hey, you know?
Well, you're right. That might not be a bad idea.
Yeah,
I wasn't saying it was a bad idea. I just said it could be the recipe
Mitsubishi
of the...
meatballs.
Mitsubishi meatballs.
Boeing. Boeing. I don't know. Bouillabaisse.
There you go.
Airbus avocados. We got a lot of things going there. We could start a food cooking show. I keep wanting to do that. You know. Yeah. I mean, how about Piasecki pancakes or? Or waffle rotors, or, you know, there's a lot. We could do a lot with food.
And you know, right about now, people that are listening to this are saying, remember when you guys said earlier about the fact that without a guest, you guys get a little crazy and a little off? Do you guys know that it's happening right now?
It's coming
now,
true.
All right, so
let's get kind of techie with this next item. All this right. is, and I like this one. You guys will figure out why in about a second, but this is from Aviation Week. Rolls-Royce reveals next-gen engine plan. Now, Rolls-Royce has unveiled this strategic roadmap, and they tell us what they intend to do with future engines. And interestingly enough, the plan includes a geared turbofan. So this happens in kind of two stages. The first is something they call the advance engine. That's what they call it, the advance. And I gather it's based on the Trent XWB engine, but it's got a new core. And they say this is going to have a 20% fuel burn improvement over the Trent 700, which, of course, powers the Airbus A330. It's looking like maybe an initial demonstrator in 2015, and it could enter service from 2020 onwards. That's the first phase of this. So the second one is what they call the ultra fan, and that's where they have a geared fan drive system like the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine. When I say like, I don't know how like it is, but something with a gear. Rolls says that that'll give at least a 25% fuel burn improvement over the Trent 700, and that's looking like something that's ready for service out in 2025 and beyond. So that's farther into the future. Interesting, and we've mentioned several times, I think, we've seen what Pratt & Whitney's doing with the geared turbofan. We've seen what GE is doing with CFM on the LeapX engine. And we've commented, well, what's Rolls-Royce doing? We're not hearing anything from Rolls-Royce, or at least not to the same degree. And now they're starting to kind of give us a little peek at what's in the future.
20% fuel burn improvement. That's pretty significant.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'm not an engine guy, but that almost sounds as if, are we sure you believe that?
Yeah, of course. Well, that's what they said with the geared turbofan engine from Pratt, and that's, you know, that it was going to get double-digit fuel burn improvement. 20% is high. Most people these days Pratt and CFM are talking in the sort of the 15%, sort of the mid teens kind of percent improvement in fuel burn. So 20% and 25% for the ultra fan, yeah, is a huge improvement. So that's great stuff.
Wow, yeah, especially. You know, and it's funny, somebody, we were talking over the weekend about how the aviation industry's changed just in the last decade with the incredible increases in the price of fuel. And
yeah,
I was talking to somebody about what the fuel prices were like in the, let's see, when was the big oil thing? I think that was in the 70s, the first one we had, mid-70s. And somebody said, well, what the heck happened in the last 5 or 6 years that made oil prices go nuts? And I'm not sure if I know. Do you guys know?
Volume.
I didn't have an answer.
Volume.
It's,
I mean,
just volume,
line,
you think?
Well, you've got back in the 70s, the high volume use for fuel was the United States. It had the biggest industrial complex. Now think about, we haven't ever lost our appetite for fuel, but now mix in things like China, India. I mean, and there, it's a fixed resource, and there's a lot more people using it. Not to mention the United States has gotten even thirstier for it. So it's supply and demand. There's a lot of people using it that we weren't using it 40 years ago.
But yeah, think about that supply and demand thing. Just because the supply is the same or only slightly increasing and the demand is stronger, why does the price it shouldn't be that the price must go up. It means the price probably will go up, right? Because the oil suppliers can do it. But there's nothing necessarily that it doesn't cost them more to produce oil when 20 times more people want it than it does any other time, right?
Yeah, and there are some people that maintain that the pricing is manipulated, that there are forces, political and other forces out there that do that. So it's really hard to say. I think the only thing that seems really certain to me is that it's not going to return to where it was. And so aviation is a big consumer of fuel. I've seen different numbers. It depends on whose study, but I think generally it's around 5% of the global use of fuel, petroleum-based fuel is consumed by aviation of one sort or another. So it's a significant issue. And as far as the engines are concerned, the big way you get increased fuel burn, reduced fuel burn, is to increase the fan size. Bigger and bigger fans, so that the fans are contributing more of the total propulsive force, gives you lower fuel burn. But as the fans get larger, they get heavier, and so weight reduction becomes much more important. And that's why you see more use of composites in engines. That's part of the Rolls-Royce Advantage engine approach, is to use more composites, for example, like in the fan blades. And the other thing is that you want that fan to turn at a lower speed. As you increase the diameter of the fan, the speed of the tip increases, and you don't want that tip speed to go supersonic. So you need, the larger the fan, the slower it needs to turn. The trouble is when it's coupled to the turbine, which is the way it works before the geared turbofan for these kinds of engines, if it's coupled to the turbine, you have to slow the turbine down, and now you're really losing efficiency. So the idea with the gear is you can spin the turbine at a high speed where it wants to live, and you can spin the fan in front at a lower speed where it wants to operate. So we see Rolls moving in that direction. You know, another question I've heard is, well, how come GE doesn't do this? And my answer to that is always, how do you know they're not working on that? You know, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But interesting. We'll put a link to this. Addison had a interesting article on this too at airinsight.com. Rolls-Royce gets its gear, and we'll put a link to that one in the show notes also.
A lot of skunk works out there that we don't know about.
There's a lot of stuff out there we don't know about. And another interesting, what a great lead-in, Rob. Another interesting area in aviation is 3D printing. Now, I think by now almost everybody has run across these 3D printers. They've been around for a while. Smaller versions that you can almost have in your home are available now. And this is a technology that's referred to as being additive as opposed to a subtractive manufacturing approach. Classically, aircraft parts, engine parts, you start with a bigger piece of metal and you machine it down to the shape that you need for that part. And that's subtractive manufacturing. You're machining away the part. With a 3D printer, you're building it up from nothing. That's additive. So you're taking, it can be a plastic, it can be a metal, and through various means in this printer, with quotes around printer, you're building up the part. So we see in, this is from Motley Fool, I think, 3D printing in the aerospace industry, how General Electric and United Technologies are using this technology. And they're being used for engine parts. Boeing is using them to print parts for its planes. And we're seeing more and more of this. there's some other articles. Lockheed Martin, Airbus are also using this technology. So again, it's another, you know, kind of interesting area where things are changing and technology is being used to make parts lighter or stronger or, you know, whatever is necessary in order to decrease the fuel burn, decrease the emissions, and so forth. It's an interesting time.
Wow. You're haven't lost your touch, have you? Can tell you came from the manufacturing side of the world.
Yeah, this is pretty cool stuff. You watch these parts just form up, you know, before your very eyes. We also see that China is developing this capability as well. China's got it's developing the world's largest 3D printer, and they're using this mostly for military applications. So I don't know, David, if you've run across
that. How surprising.
Yeah, I know. What a shock, right?
Everything's military until it sort of ekes out of the civilian. But, you know, again, it's China doing what China does best, taking technology from the rest of the world and making it their own. So for military applications, yeah, you could see a lot of stuff coming along the lines, not to mention UAVs, but which seems to be a parallel argument, but we could talk about that on the other show, where it always seems that 3D printers are mentioned in same terms with UAVs. It's kind of a parallel technology. But I agree with Rob. Clearly, this is your expertise, and we're not used to hearing you getting hot and bothered over things like machine shops or geared turbofans.
Yeah, you know, I think that's exactly what I was thinking, David. That's a good point.
We need to have more stories for Max to get excited over.
Yeah, well, maybe if he does this long enough, something will kind of, you know, float his boat.
You know, we're a couple months away only from our 6th year anniversary for this Airplane Geeks podcast.
Good grief. And let's see, when is it? The end of April, I think, or beginning of May?
It's in June sometime.
Oh, it's in June.
Yeah, I think it's in June.
Just before we go to the Udvar-Hazy Center in Washington?
That's
and only 11, actually, and only that's, 11 and only 11 weeks away from our 300th episode.
Oh my Lord, I remember when we were 200.
That's right. It just seems like years ago.
Yeah.
Seems like we do this every week.
Yeah, that little scallywag Dan was still with us there, wasn't he? They grow up so fast.
They do. All right, so let's move on, and we've got a message now from Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association. He's going to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Cool.
Hey, guys. This week on NBAA's Flight Plan, we look at the president's budget. You know, the part where he wants to enact aviation user fees. What's the National Business Aviation Association doing about it? I'm Pete Combs. Find out on NBAA's Flight Plan at nbaa.org.
You can find Flight Plan at the NBAA site, which, of course, is www.nbaa.org.
You don't really have to say www, do you? Doesn't everybody kind of know when you give them a URL that it's nbaa.org and it's...
I just like saying www.
Oh, you just like to say www. I see. Okay.
Okay. All right. Believe it or not... You know, I think this is going to be the unplugged episode. I'm thinking right now, no editing. This is just going to go as it goes. Airplane Geeks Unplugged. All right, well now, believe it or not, it's time for the Australia Desk. So here's Grant and Steve.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 3rd of March, 2014.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for this week for episode 289. And, Grant, what a very, very busy weekend for us. It was the Royal Australian Air Force's celebration of 100 years of military aviation here in Australia.
Mate, that's right. It was absolutely a fantastic event. I only got to see one day of it, but I was flat out. I didn't really get to see much in the way of flying activities, actually. I saw some here and there, and I heard lots of sounds and everything, but I was flat out doing interviews around the JSF mock-up, talking to a Lockheed test pilot about the F-35, to the Lockheed rep here in Australia, and a number of other folks. We got a couple of really good interviews around there, and of course the notification that the first two RAAF pilots who are going over to the US to start their training have been announced. So got to meet them and have a chat. So for me, it was a lot of schmoozing as well to start organizing all the other events we've got coming up and all the other projects we've got for the year.
Yes, never a dull moment over here at the Australia Desk. And I tell you what, Grant, it was nice to get away from all the doom and gloom. Of course, Qantas has dominated the news this week. We talked last week a bit about it with predictions of mass job cuts. Well, of course, not long after that went to air, Qantas came out and announced that there would be upwards of 5,000 full-time equivalent jobs, which, you know, means there's going to be more because, you know, two part-time jobs equals one full-time job. So a lot of people are going to lose their jobs at Qantas. The retirement of their 767 fleet by next year, and obviously, getting rid of some of their 747s, Grant, and also delaying a lot of orders. So a lot of bad news there. They're losing a lot of money, or at least they're making out that they're losing a lot of money, and the brinkmanship continues. But I guess going over to the air show at Point Cook was a welcome diversion from that.
Oh, it certainly was, mate. It was absolutely wonderful to not really have to think about it for a while and just to get some total immersion in some really wonderful aviation. Went out to Point Cook on the Friday with Errol Cavett, our Kiwi mate, who was over here and joined up with us to take still photos. We got him in on our media pass. And we went in on the Friday to go and enjoy the box kite replica. So that was really good. I really enjoy the replicas, so that really helped. And getting away from Qantas, absolutely wonderful.
And folks, if you'd like to see video of the replica Bristol box kite flying, you can head over to our YouTube channel and or over to our Facebook page, and you can see a video there that our video guru Stephen Pam made of that flight. I'll tell you what, looks rather flimsy, mate. I think I'd rather be flying in a 737 myself, but one of the people though we did get to speak to there, I got to speak to, and you know, I'll tell you what, I wasn't half nervous, I'll tell you, it was Air Marshal Jeff Brown, who is the Chief of Air Force. Air Marshal Brown, thanks very much for taking some time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
The significance of the day, we're here, the 100 years of military aviation here at Point Cook. Can you tell us from an Air Force perspective, obviously, you know, what this means to the Air Force today?
Well, there's not too many times you get to do 100 years.
I guess not.
Of military aviation. So to do it on the same weekend, and this is a very special weekend, that we actually flew the box kite 100 years ago when it all started, military aviation in Australia, I think is special. So we've got pretty much the full spectrum of Air Force aeroplanes from the box kite right through on display today, including all of our current types. So it's a pretty special day.
Now, we always like to ask everybody who comes on the show about their history. And you joined the Air Force in 1980, so you've obviously been a long path to get to where you are now.
Yeah, no, it's 34 years ago now, basically. So and it's been a great career. I've had a lot of great experiences flying different types. You know, started off flying helicopters and then did a lot of instructing and then into F-18s and F-111s and still fly occasionally these days.
Okay, what do you fly these days? What do you get out privately or?
Yeah, I've got my own sailplane glider, so I still fly that. Probably only once a year. I go to our national championships and compete. I get about 40 or 50 hours in about 2 weeks.
Oh, nice.
That
nice.
Does me for the year.
Well, that's pure flying, isn't it? Sailplane flying, yeah.
It is. So I've been doing that since I was about 13 or 14. Right. Cadets, got a scholarship, and always sort of kept it up in between my military flying.
Right, so that's a good point, coming through cadets. Is that your initial interest? Is that how you became interested in coming in?
Yes. You know, I started on cadets. I was always interested in flying, and, you know, we've still got a great cadet organisation, about 7,000 cadets and 168 units right around Australia. So if you are interested in the Air Force, it's still not a bad way to go in.
It's a great recruiting tool, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Now, you talked about flying helicopters. Let's talk about it. CH-47s, a unique aircraft.
They are. Yeah. They are incredibly flexible. Just could lift an amazing amount of stuff. Didn't have the same sort of limitations as other helicopters because they were dual rotor. Yeah, it was an amazing 3 years. Got about 1,000 hours.
Right. So tell us about some of the obviously such a unique helicopter and counter-rotating blades. Is it a stable helicopter? I often think that helicopters should defy the laws of physics and screw themselves into the ground, but maybe not so much with the Chinook.
No, but you know, you just got to do some amazing things with it. Lifting containers off ships, lifting Boston aircraft out of New Guinea, flying around New Guinea, lifting loads, bulldozers and things like that.
Yep.
Working with the army, with artillery, moving fire support bases from one place to another. So it was, it was a great experience.
I'm interested about the dynamic of flying with something dangling underneath, and I guess the pendulum effect. Is that obviously a very challenging thing to learn to come to grips with?
It is, and it depends very much on the load as well. Different loads have different characteristics. Take, for example, a Land Rover, you could probably only do take it at about 100 knots. The more unstable the load was, the slower that you had to go.
Yeah.
Occasionally, when you experimented with loads, you'd have to drop them off because they got too unstable.
Right, okay. And I guess wind would be obviously weather conditions and that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Although the Chinook was a little less prone than most helicopters to wind direction because of the double rotors, so it could take off downwind, and basically with the two rotors, you didn't have the same limitations as tail rotor.
Yeah. Do they have a good engine out? For example, how do you auto-rotate these things to the ground?
Don't have to, because it had two engines, transmissions on the front of those. They went in a combining transmission. Then one shaft to the front, one shaft to the back, another transmission to drive the rotors. So if you lost an engine, the one engine would just keep driving both rotors. So it wasn't a big emergency.
And obviously we're been used to great effect, particularly over in the Middle East area of operations.
Yeah, they've done some great things over in Afghanistan. They've been, because the conditions in Afghanistan have required a lot of performance because it's high altitude. And the Chinook, in lots of ways, is the ideal helicopter for us.
Yeah, outstanding. Now, I wanted to talk to you, obviously, about transitioning from rotary wing aircraft, and particularly something as unique as the CH-47, into flying fast jets. That's a rather different path to take.
Yeah, although the way Air Force does its pilot's course, it still does its pilot's course, you basically train to jet standard. When I was around, we had the Mackie 326. So it was really a matter of just refreshing on the jets, because our basic training had taken us that far anyway, so it really wasn't too much of a problem.
That's something I find, well, it seems to me that's unique to the Royal Australian Air Force, or I guess smaller sized air forces like ours, where people tend to multitask. I spent a lot of time exposed to the US Air Force, where it seems if somebody flies Type A, that's what they stay in.
I think that the small Air Force, and it's one of the advantages of small Air Force, is you need to have flexibility with your people. And when the Air Force owned the helicopters, it was a great breeding ground for fighter pilots in lots of ways, because they could actually get a lot of captain hours quite early, and you got experience very quickly, and you matured, and then they had a look at you to fly fighters after that.
Yeah. And do you still find that most young people coming into the Air Force have got their eyes on fast jets?
Well, I think so at the start, yeah, certainly. But it really doesn't matter what you fly, the experience is amazing. You know, if you look at C-17s and C-130s and P-3s, they're pretty exciting operations.
All of our listeners would know, they've been listening to our show for a long time, that the Hercules is my favourite. If had I ever been successful to get into the RAF, that's what I would have wanted to have flown. But yeah. I find myself unique in that viewpoint sometimes.
No, its nickname is the Fat Albert, but it's been the workhorse of the Air Force for 50 years.
Yeah.
And it's been an amazing airplane, and the crews have amazing experiences. So I've flown into Afghanistan with them. You know, just recently they did a lot of great work in the Philippines on typhoons. And,
they'll be around forever, won't they?
They'll be around for a while longer.
And there we go, Grant. I tell you what, it's good to relax into an interview like that. I must apologise about the background noise. It was very, very noisy. Obviously, any time you go to an air show like that, it's going to be noisy. But I think in that room where we recorded that, there was more military brass in that room, I think, than I've ever seen anywhere in my life, including the Avalon media launch.
Yeah, there were a lot of group captains and upwards at Avalon. So I would imagine that you'd have group captains, air vice marshals and so on, a plethora of them.
And a big shout out to our very own historian, David Vanderhoof, who gave me some great pointers to ask Air Marshal Brown regarding CH-47 Chinook flying, because I don't know all that much about it. But David, obviously living just down the road from the factory, obviously knows a lot about that. So thanks, David. Really appreciate it, mate. And that interview will go for about 15 minutes, the full version. version of that one, so that'll be coming up in a very soon-to-be-released episode of Plane Crazy Down Under. So that's everything we have for you this week, folks, and of course, now we've got to get ready for next weekend and another air show down at Tyab, a local one here in Victoria, which is always a very big event. Grant, I think we better get this one edited and get lots of sleep before then.
Oh, I don't know about the sleep, mate. I'm off to Canberra tomorrow for the F-35 cockpit sim. I'll be down at East Sale at the airbase on Friday to record the F-18s, and then we've got Saturday, Sunday and Monday at the air show to record this DVD for them.
Oh, well, it beats working for a living, that's all I can say. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm the stressing Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Thanks, guys. That Bristol box kite, that's I looked that up. That's a really interesting interesting aircraft, David. It's not a box kite. It has nothing to do with being a kite.
Well, no, but I mean, it is all fabric wires, and it is a giant. The wing really is a giant box. So it is a very unique early aircraft.
Really early. A pusher biplane.
Yep. It's not quite far after Wright Brothers, you know, so you're talking that kind of vintage, and it's neat to see a restoration like that and someone who's got enough guts to go joyride in it, kind of like where we had with the Curtis Pusher for the Naval Aviation Centennial. So it's definitely, you got to have a lot of guts to go flying in something that's basically just fabric tubing and wires.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, Rob, do we have an Aviation Minute coming up next?
Well, we sure do. In fact, just one quick comment on that last A comment to the last comment. There's a word for those kind of airplanes, guys. Having had a tube and a fabric airplane for a long time, my friends used to call my airplane a bag of rags. So that's kind
what
of
did what you have?
I had a 7 ECA Citabria, which is a little tail dragger, and it's what eventually became higher horsepower Citabrias, and then the Decathlon, which is now 180 horse, I believe. But little tail dragger.
And what is Citabria backwards for?
It's aerobatic, spelled backwards.
Very good.
Because well, if you go kinda, upside down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember the first time I did that. I taught myself how to do loops, and first time I was upside down, I never realized that all the junk that was on the floor comes down and hits you in the head. It was really cool. But anyway, yes, we do have an Aviation Minute coming up, and this week we're talking about the Transportation Security Administration and weapons. And for once, I'm actually, well, I won't even tell anybody what my perspective is on the TSA. I'll just let them give a listen and see what they think. So here we go. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. Since the TSA was born just over a decade ago, they've cost the American taxpayers somewhere around $80 million. All of that money's been spent on a mission of keeping us safe from the kinds of people who pulled the wool over our eyes on 9/11. Since then, of course, anyone who travels on the airlines realizes it's become torture, at least compared to the pre-9/11 days. But for a moment, I'd like to paraphrase comedian Rodney Dangerfield and suggest that, well, maybe the TSA don't get no respect. And I think they deserve some. When it comes to weapons and airplanes, we Americans seem to have a pretty short memory. Consider this. After screening 638 million airline passengers in 2012, that's about 1.8 million a day, the TSA confiscated 1,556 guns, 80% of which were loaded. The top five airports for grabbing guns? Atlanta, Dallas-Fort Worth, Phoenix, Houston, and Fort Lauderdale. So maybe you're thinking these are all simply loaded guns. Guns that law-abiding citizens simply, well, forgot they'd stashed in their pockets or briefcases. I don't think so. Consider the handguns found in potted plants, stuffed animals, and even in carved-out hollows of a book. Or the pistol wrapped in tinfoil hidden inside a DVD player. Did you know the TSA is also grabbing automatic weapons, hand grenades, and even cans of black powder? If these weren't enough to make you say wow, ask yourself this.
What were these people planning on doing with all this stuff once the airplane took off? For the Aviation Minute, I'm Rob Mark in Chicago. See you next time. Wasn't that incredible?
Very good, hey, Rob. Now, you're going to make these available over on Jetwine as well, I understand.
Yes. In fact, even as we're sitting here, I'm working on a separate RSS feed for just the Aviation Minutes because I didn't think of that. Somebody that was listening sent me an email and said, hey, you're going to do that? And I thought, sure.
Yeah.
Great idea. So that's what we're going to do. Right. So those folks that just want to listen to those little babies will be able to get them off every week.
I think that just dovetails nicely with the best story this week, which was out of the Onion, where they decided that the FAA decided that the best thing to do for airport security is to eliminate passengers from flights on airplanes for everybody across the board.
Yes, the risk goes down considerably.
So they had a lot of good justifications, and if you listen to UAV Digest, you should be on your third shot now because I'm about to say FAA again. So
that's right. We have a game over there, Rob, the FAA drinking game. Every time we say FAA, you take a drink.
Well, okay. So would you be having good drinks or bad drinks when you say FAA?
Well, I'm not sure, but I tell you have frequent drinks.
I see. Because, so then yeah, these must get to be really exciting right by the end. Okay.
Right. All right. Now let's listen to Peter Johnson across the pond.
Okay. Well, let's stay in Europe. Etihad is rescuing or could possibly rescue Alitalia. Have Alitalia finally got out of jail?
Not really. I mean, they were going into the final due diligence. I think it's like 30 days to go. And Etihad is approaching the banks to forgive some of the Alitalia debt.
Yeah.
So that they can invest in it. Of course, Lufthansa came out and asked the EU to block the deal.
Yeah.
Which actually, because their rationale is we don't want European carriers to be owned by foreign carriers.
Yeah.
And that prompted the Prime Minister of Italy to come out and say that Lufthansa fears competition. Seems to be an accusation wielded against legacy carriers all over the place because, as you recall, Norwegian Air CEO accused US legacy carriers of not knowing how to compete because they tried to block his shuttle from Ireland to the States.
Yeah.
So there might be something to that they're so used to constrained capacity that it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, but we recently talked about stakes in Serbia as well. I mean, this is an inevitable part of growth of some of these cash-rich airlines that need to put their money somewhere, and keeping airlines and legacy carriers like Alitalia, it's probably their last hope.
Well, I mean, you need to consider Alitalia. Italy is the third largest travel market in Europe. And to go without a national carrier or a major carrier in there, I mean, you have to remember that Lufthansa actually used to own part of Alitalia and it withdrew.
Yeah.
And Air France KLM still own an equity.
Yeah, that's right. What do you think their view will be about this then, Osama? What do you think KLM and Air France are thinking about this? I mean, I know they don't want to pump any more money into Alitalia.
Well, they mentioned a few weeks ago that they would consider pumping money into Alitalia if certain conditions were met. Now, I'm not sure what the certain conditions are. However, we have to remember that Air France KLM have a very, very good code share agreement with Etihad, which goes way beyond, a little bit beyond a code share, the normal regular code share.
Yeah.
So Air France KLM has an interest in Etihad, so they have to balance between not upsetting Etihad too much.
Yeah.
And not giving in too much to Etihad. But what people have to understand, both in Europe and in the United States, that if we keep saying that airlines and aviation is a global business, we cannot go forever saying you cannot open up for European and American airlines for investment by foreign airlines. Yeah. Otherwise, where is the global portion of the globality of the industry? I mean, who else is going to come? Bankers are not going to go there and invest because they don't understand the business. And airline business is not exactly, you know, internet stocks. The yield on their shares is very low. So it's never been a very, you know, cash cow type thing. So it's a low yield, high risk business, which is susceptible to everything from pandemics to wars, to weather, to natural disasters.
So, yeah.
You know, and an airline brings in, and an airline investor brings in a lot of things with them. It brings in feed, it creates traffic, both into and, you know, to the country and outside of the country. It's a win-win situation. And Etihad has been very, very accommodating with its equity stakes, that in the sense that it actually helped them out. Like Air Berlin, they talked about 787, rationalization of the 787 purchases of parts, etc. With Air Serbia, they're talking about using some of the Etihad A320s to revamp, to improve the fleet and the service of the airline. So it's not like they're coming there and, you know, in a few years they're going to sell them out and leave.
And how does the deal, Etihad Regional, the deal in Switzerland, how does that fit their strategy?
Well, it brings in feed from smaller city pairs to their hubs in Europe. I mean, you have to know that Etihad flies to Milan, to Zurich, to Geneva, to Berlin, and their partners in Europe don't necessarily fly from smaller second-tier airports, which Etihad Regional or Darwin Airways does.
Yeah.
And in the coming 12 months, they're going to increase flights. They're going to rationalize some of their routes to actually make sure that they maximize the traffic flow into these major cities that Etihad operates from.
Yeah.
And not necessarily only Etihad, because they could also bring in traffic to Air Berlin and so on.
Yeah. And, of course, we've also seen the news that they're co-chairing with Aer Lingus as well. So the net across Europe from Italy to Switzerland to Ireland this week on Across the Pond continues.
Yeah. Well, this is Etihad's way of actually becoming a global carrier. They don't want to join an alliance, and they're not going to be as big as Emirates in the near future. So the next thing is you buy yourself into certain airlines. And they've, of course, I mean, everybody says they're picking on weak airlines that are in financial trouble, but why would a strong airline want to sell an equity share?
Yeah, it's intriguing. This is a great game of chess around the world as all these airlines, particularly the new and dominant ones from the Middle East, start spreading. Osama, thank you very much again for your insight into this part of the world. Where can we find out about you online?
I'm on Twitter at obsalah, O-B-S-A-L-A-H, and I have my blog, samastake.blogspot.com.
Excellent. Osama, thank you very much for joining us again.
My pleasure, Peter.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from Across the Pond.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah, I think that's really interesting how some of these airlines are expanding and growing and the strategies they're undertaking to compete more on a global basis. And, you know, this is kind of what we're seeing. It's the competition is heating up, and the competition doesn't always come from, you know, traditional traditional ways. You can get more competition in a lot of different ways, and we're seeing that out of the Middle East airlines in many
cases. Of course, we've done that in the States for years and years and years. As the smaller carriers would end up in financial trouble, somebody would either buy them out, merge with them, or wait until they failed and then go in and buy all the goodies.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think
there's nothing wrong with that.
No. It's, hey, listen, that's the way it works. And it's not always pleasant for the employees, for sure, or passengers sometimes. But unfortunately, that's the way it works.
All right. Well, before we get to the listener mail, hey, I got a little addendum from last episode from 288. And we're back to engines, guys. Last episode, Rob, you asked what engine was on the Sukhoi Superjet 100.
Yes.
And I said it was Russian.
Right.
And except that's only half right.
It's only half Russian?
It's only half Russian, yeah.
What, the outside is Russian and the inside is something else?
Well,
beat me to it. And I was going to say either the left side or the right side.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
The other half is French, it turns out. Yeah, the
backside.
The Superjet uses a power jet engine. It's the SAM 146. Now, power jet is a joint venture, a 50-50 joint venture between the French company Snecma and the Russian company NPO Saturn. NPO Saturn is an engine company, and Snecma, of course, is one half of the joint venture with GE, which creates the CFM 56 engines that are on, they're on a lot of things. They're exclusive on the Boeing 737, and they're also on the A320 family, things like that. No one caught me on that. No one called me out. But when I said it was a Russian engine, it's not really. It's this joint venture between the Russian company and Snecma from France. So just to clear that up.
So you had your Blue Angel moment where you wake up in the middle of the morning and say, shoot, I forgot the F7U.
That's right. Well, we'll talk about that. Yes. All right. So now on to some listener mail. We heard from the judge, Arthur Rosen, the retired judge. We've heard quite a lot from listeners after our discussion about aviation museums, with lots of suggestions and information coming in. And one of the museums on the list we talked about was the Pima, the Air and Space Museum. Is it the Air and Space?
Yeah, Pima Air and Space.
The Pima Air and Space Museum outside of Tucson. And Arthur wrote in and said that, don't know the last time you were at Pima, but several indoor buildings have been added in the last few years. And the SR-71 is now inside. And when I was there years ago, the SR-71 was outside, actually under some, like a canopy kind of an arrangement. Arthur says that the Air Force One used to be open inside, but because of deterioration, it is now closed to the general public. He also says the Boneyard is not next door, but a good bus ride away. Maybe the gate's not next door, but the fence was, or at least it used to be. But anyway, Arthur says you have to take a special bus, which you cannot leave during the tour, which I think makes sense. They probably don't want you walking around inside the Boneyard there. He says they have several ICBM missiles, which I didn't know, and B-52s there. He says the A-4, F-4s are disappearing as they are converted to drones and shot down. He says not much of a target as they are in a straight and level flight when they're used as a target. Arthur also says he's surprised that Palm Springs was not on the list, or that Palm Springs was on the list in the San Diego Air and Space Museum, which is located in Balboa Park, home of the San Diego Zoo. He said this is one of the best gems of aviation that he's found in the U.S. And he sent along a couple of pictures. One is, I guess it's his father-in-law's F-4U at Pima from the Korean War. So that's kind of cool to have a personal connection like that. That's very nice. Arthur also goes on to talk about next gen. We talked about that recently. He says this technology is now approximately 25 years old. He says the free weather with ADS-B is equivalent to aviator light on XM weather. He says when ADS-B is fully completed, whenever that is, the government wants to sell you the good weather features. So, Rob, do you know this aviator light on XM weather? Do you use XM weather?
I do. It's already part of the subscription in the Cirrus. I had not heard this aviation light, though. This is a new one on me.
Huh. Okay. And then Arthur says the purpose of NextGen is for airliners to fly direct instead of using airways. So when so then you will have every airline arriving and departing to and from approximately 35 commercial airports at the same time, and we'll all have to hold. He says there's no perceivable benefit of NextGen to general aviation. In fact, GA airplanes will have to have a transponder on board. That's right. In addition to ADS-B, so that airline TCAS will work. And that's from Arthur.
It's FAA. So I think we need to start a new pool, and everybody can start putting this in. What will come first, NextGen or the integration of UAVs into the
commercial airspace?
So we'll start taking bragging rights pools. So put in your date when that will come in, and send us know, and we'll keep score. And if we're around in 2090, we'll let you know.
Oh, hopefully it's before then.
I will be.
You're counting on that, huh?
Yeah. Okay. I was watching the Oscars last night, and they were talking about a lady who had just passed away. I forgot what her name was, but they said, well, you know what? She made it to 110.
Yes. That's pretty amazing. You're going to do that, too.
Oh, man, I'm here. And this is the Airplane Geeks, episode 9411. It's going to be our 95th anniversary soon.
Yeah, you'll be hosting that one by yourself, I think.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And then continuing on with aviation museums, we heard from Henda, a woman captain at SA Express. She says, I'm a CRJ 200 and 700 captain at a regional airline in South Africa, also an avid listener to your wonderful podcast, so please keep up the great work. Thank you, Henda. She says, as per your episode 287, request for museums on the African continent, please check out the SAAF Museum at Zwakop Air Force Base in Pretoria. She says it's the oldest Air Force base in the country, and they have a great selection of aircraft, especially Mirages. And she says, I'd like to hear more of the African aviation news on your podcast. And that's a good point. We don't have a lot of coverage of African aviation news here. Maybe that's something we should work on.
I thought that was Peter's job. I thought he was covering the rest of the world.
We're giving him the rest. So we've got Stephen Grant in Australia in that region, us here, and Peter's the rest of the world.
Yeah, I thought that was the breakdown. Maybe I'm wrong.
Does he know that? So,
yeah. But I wrote back to Henda and said, yeah, and we'll shout it out to her that she could always send us news stories so we can talk about it. Not that we'll know much. My two goals is we need somebody to talk about Latin America and somebody to talk about Africa. Then we've got the whole, we've completed world domination for Airplane Geek.
Yeah, that's what we need. Okay. All right, good. We also heard from Lucas. Lucas wrote in and said, in a recent episode, David referred to the CV-22 as the Marines version, but it is the MV-22B. He says he must have misspoken because I know he has referred to it correctly in the past. And David, you just sort of did slip up on that one, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I jokingly said to him that I said, the problem with the MV-22 and the CV-22 is the Navy decided that they were worried that if someone said CV-22, they'd be talking about the USS Independence aircraft carrier. So they decided that the Marines would be the MV-22, when almost all special ops aircraft begin with the word M, as in MH-60 or MC-130 or et cetera. So if you go back and listen to me talk about that at the time, you'll hear a deep breath as the cells in the back of my head were trying to remember, okay, which one is which, because I know it's backwards. The other thing he talked about in this was the Pensacola for the Naval History, the National Museum of Naval Aviation, as well as a good one that I liked out in Omaha, Nebraska, in the middle of cornfields, is the Strategic Air Command Museum, which is really kind of cool. It's kind of surrealistic. You're driving along this highway in the summer, and you've got miles and miles of corn, and that is why Nebraska is known as the Corn Huskers. But suddenly an SR-71 in front of a building pops up, and it's a very clean, neat museum where all of the aircraft was originally displayed out in Offutt. But they have a B-52, they have a Vulcan bomber, they have a B-58 Hustler, one of the few that are around. So it's definitely a little out of the way, but if you ever get to Omaha, Nebraska, take the 45-minute drive out in the countryside. It's pretty, and you'll get to see the SAC Museum.
Cool. All right. We've been getting a lot of good suggestions. That's a great one, too. And it turns out Peter Johnson also happened to see this email, and he pointed out that back in episode 19 of Extended, that he had Captain Brian Link on the show, and the captain was involved in the MV-22 development. And so if you want to hear more about that, if you haven't heard episode 19 of Peter Johnson's Aviation Extended podcast, you can go check that out. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Can I add one also dovetail to this story?
Yeah, sure.
Here in Philadelphia on Saturday, we had the commissioning of the USS Somerset, which is
right.
Which is an amphibious dock ship, and it commemorates Somerset County, where Flight 93 crashed. So it's the third, and in fact, the bow has some metal from the crash of Flight 93. So she's dedicated to Flight 93. And they had the big commissioning ceremony, and we got to see a bunch of people become plank holders. For anybody who doesn't know naval history, and my father is one of these, is the first crew of a ship, they become officially known as plank holders, meaning that they get to keep one of the planks from the deck, which is... But so we had some commissioning of the Somerset, and there's nothing better than seeing a bunch of sailors waiting on the side of the ship in full dress and hearing the command, sailors, make this ship alive, and they all run to their station. So if anyone gets to see a commissioning, I definitely recommend it. And Somerset does have a aviation tradition, like the USS New York, which is the same class, has World Trade Center medal, Flight 93's medal, and on the back in the hangar, it says "Let's roll, Flight 93." So she's got a Nav Geek history, and I Godspeed to the Somerset.
Yeah, for sure. All right, good. Paul Sherlock sent us in a couple of photos from the municipal building, believe it or not, in Burlington Township, New Jersey, and there one of these is an F-86H. I guess this is David, right?
Yep, it's an F-86H, which was the heavy fighter-bomber version of the Korean War fighter. It has two cannons instead of six 50 calibers and a bigger engine and kind of a Fury-like tail. I know that's way too much information for everybody, but that's me geeking out on.
No, it's cool.
An F-86.
Yeah, and we'll put the picture in the show notes so you can take a look at that. Those are the two you can see in the front on the nose on the side. Those two sort of black things. Those are the 50 caliber.
On a normal F-86, not the H, you would see three rows of guns all in a line. In this case, the F-86H was a heavier aircraft, a F-86 plus, I guess. And it has two cannons, so for additional firepower. So it's kind of cool.
All right. Thanks for sending those in, Paul. Like I say, we'll put one or both of those in the show notes. And then we heard from Harry in the UK. He says, love the show. He's a frequent listener. Now get ready, Rob. This is where Rob gets a big head. I love the new Aviation Minute segment, and I was interested to hear about the different points of view about the pilot shortage, which were mentioned in last week's episode, which at the time for him was episode 287. He said that over here in the UK, British Airways are running something called the Future Pilot Program. He says, I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's designed to take someone from no flying experience to sitting in the right seat of their Airbus or Boeing aircraft in 15 months. It requires a security deposit of around £84,000, but this is refunded to you once you start flying for them. It's a great scheme, he says. Once you complete the course, you get a job as a first officer with British Airways. So this places you in a good job in a big airline and takes a lot of the stress out of trying to fund a flying career. He says, thought you guys might like to hear about this and how the pilot shortage situation is over the pond. Great podcast, guys. Keep it up. And that's from Harry.
Well, I think that's pretty neat, actually. And, fact that they have a way for people to go from zero time or low time to a job is the goal. And now, when he mentions that security deposit, though, that my guess is that people would say, my God, I don't have 84,000 quid. I mean, my guess is that there's some way to sign and not actually have to transfer a great deal of money to make that happen. Because as I said last week, and by the way, thank you very much for that nice comment on the Aviation Minute. Always nice to hear. Always looking for ideas, too. But I think it's important for people to realize that that's really what people want is the job, and that there are a lot of people around the world that would, you know, practically give their eye teeth in order to have that kind of an opportunity. Yeah, I'll sign up. I'll stay with you for 10 years. And I know someone mentioned it to me the other day that they thought that was like being an indentured servant. Or was that on the show last week? Did we talk about that? Do you guys remember that phrase?
That comment came out, yeah.
I mean, I don't see it that way. Because, again, I think that it's the money that is really taking people away from this career. Of course, another issue that is different in the UK is that they don't have that 1,500-hour ATP requirement as we do for 121 carriers here in the States, to the best of my knowledge. And so that makes it easier for them to take someone and train them and get them to, you know, 300-400 hours somewhere and keep them coming along. It's that gap now that's really the problem over here that's making the lousy wages and the tough schedules, it's making it even worse. So but there are a lot of Americans that are going overseas to go fly. So
I'm sorry, but $143,758 is a lot of debt to be putting up front.
Yeah, you looked up the conversion rate.
It depends on how they're doing it. I mean, my guess is that it is not, as I said earlier, I don't think they're really having to come up with all that money. I think they're basically signing a note that says, hey, we'll work for you for 10 years. And if I were in the right seat of a 777 and I had just worked for a company that had trained me from almost zero time, how better to build employee loyalty than to make something happen that the employee couldn't have made happen on their own? I'll grant you, David, you're right. I mean, if something happens, 3 years into it and you say, I hate this place, I want to get out. Yeah, you probably got a little problem there.
All right. Well, British Airways has a website for the Future Pilot Program, and that's futurepilotprogram.co.uk. Program is spelled the way the crazy Brits spell it, you know, with extra M's and E's and things. So if you can't figure that out, just check it in the show notes and we'll have a link there.
Oh, come on. We got to talk about Robert's email about beer and flight.
Yes. Bob Randall wrote in and said, as always, I enjoyed your latest podcast. FYI, Horizon Airlines, now operating as parent Alaska, he says, has always had free micro brews and local wines featured on every flight, usually one of each. They are always sourced from Alaska or Horizon's service area. And I think this is great, actually. We talked about the article that kind of, you know, suggested to us that this was sort of a one-time or a brand-new kind of a thing. So if this is happening a lot, I think that's great. I think everybody wins in a situation like this. The passengers win because they get beer and wine, the small breweries and so forth get some publicity, and the airline's happy because they have happy passengers. So it's kind of an interesting thing, but as long as it's not overdone. I mean, you don't.
Oh, you can't overdo Washington wines. I mean, Washington State's got some fantastic wines and some microbreweries. Okay, I'm kind of biased because Robert did have in his article the "Let It Go to My Head." Some say it's the worst overcast icing environment in the United States, but as David always says, get a window seat.
That's right.
So I'm glad to see that some people are listening to my advice on IFE.
Great.
Sorry, Mary.
And Scott wrote in, too. He is similar. He said about the free microbrew in Alaska. He said Porter Airlines, that's that airline based in Toronto at the City Center Airport, they offer a complimentary steam whistle beer, red or white wine, and small meals on all legs. So that's good. So there is some service out there still.
And steam whistle is a good beer.
You know, I think it sounds really familiar. I think I might have had it.
I mean, I've had it when I've been up there visiting my brother in Toronto. So
right.
I would say it's a good choice of a beer. And Porter Airlines, they're flying out of Toronto Airport in the middle of the lake. Good for them.
Right, right. Yeah, we talked about them before. I think in connection with an order for C-Series. Right. And
they want to make sure C-Series can operate out of Toronto.
Right. And they may have to extend that runway, as I recall, was the conversation or the discussion at that time. I don't know where that's gone, but probably something we should refresh the status of just so we know. And then Mike wrote us. He said, I thought just I'd forward this notice from the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum. Said, I must highlight that I believe the CWH did not appear in your recent list of must-visit recommended aviation museums. So he says that Canada's Lancaster bomber will fly to Britain this August to form up with the only other flying Lancaster in the world and appear together at a number of events in the UK. This is billed as a, quote, never-to-happen-again event. He says, I've heard the gorgeous sound of the Lanx 4 Merlin engines purring at air shows a number of times now. Wouldn't it be amazing to hear 8 Merlins all at once? Add a few more from fighters flying in close escort formation. Whoa, he says, shivers down my back. And yeah, I had to agree. A sky filled with Merlins, David, that's got to be something special.
Yeah, the Lancaster's a really pretty airplane. You know, it does appear occasionally in the United States, Rob. But yeah, his visualization of having a couple of Mustangs and some Spitfires, as well as a pair of Lancasters, it's kind of cool. And for Britain, it would be like a pair of B-29s flying for us here in the United States. It's just, it's their airplane, and good for them. I'm glad to hear that they're actually going to do it.
Very cool. All right, we got an email from Captain Terry Reese. Now, you may remember, I think it was a long time ago, we had mentioned his book, Flying North, South, East, and West, and it being just a great read. Captain Reese has had a very long, interesting aviation career that includes bush flying in Alaska and I think running some covert op stuff and, as I recall, ending up as a 737 captain, if I remember correctly. If I don't, apologies. But he's got another book coming out, and this is called Jackal Scat. It's an aviation adventure, he says, from the wilds of Alaska to the sands of the Kalahari Desert in Africa, and available on Amazon.com. Just based on his previous writings, I think that this is something worth taking a look at. We'll put a link in the show notes to where you can find that on Amazon. I'm sure it's available in some other places, but that was definitely one of the best aviation reads I'd had in just an awful long time. One of those kind of books where you start reading it and it's just really difficult to put it down because you don't know what's going to happen next. So thanks to Captain Terry Reese for letting us know about his new book. Tim writes in, says, Dear Airplane Geeks, I'm liking the museum section in the last couple of shows. He says that he's within a half-hour drive of Duxford, which sounds like close to heaven to me. He also says the last time he was there, he met a Blackbird pilot who flew out of Mindenhall. And I think we talked about that, or Peter did maybe. I remember that there was an SR-71 pilot that had been speaking in that area.
Mildenhall. There's an L in there. Mildenhall.
What did I say? Mildenhall.
It's Mildenhall.
Mildenhall. All right. I should read this more carefully, I think. He says that there's two other unique museums near to him, a museum dedicated to de Havilland aircraft, where they have the original prototype Mosquito. That sounds cool. They also have sections of the Comet airliner where you can sit and play with all the switches. And he says, I'd also like to mention the Shuttleworth Collection, who regularly fly World War I aircraft, such as the Avro 504 and the Sopwith Camel.
Yeah, that would be on my bucket list.
Yes. So we have some links for the de Havilland Museum and the Shuttleworth also. Put those in the show notes, and you can take a look at those. And finally, I think we'll close it out with Patrick, who writes us that, well, if you're interested in a bomber, the title of this article is "A Utah Museum Has You Covered." So this comes from the Salt Lake Tribune. Hill Aerospace Museum is getting rid of 18 aircraft, 3 missiles, and some support vehicles in an effort to save money. It says that these outgoing aircraft and other items, they'll be offered to museums and base air parks and veterans organizations, hospitals, cities, things like that. And that they really want to sell these aircraft. They don't really want to scrap them, but that's sort of their last resort. So if you're, I don't know what the qualifications are. Any idea what you'd have to do or who you'd have to be in order to put a bid on one of these former military aircraft?
Actually, I do.
I had a feeling.
Believe it or not, my one of the things my father had as a project as base civil engineer at Willow Grove was he wanted to bring a $1.19 home from Davis Monathan. And one of the things that you had to do was you had to be able to afford to move it. So you had to have some way to pay for it, and the government wouldn't. So my father challenged, he had a dream set of gate guards, which was a C-130A and a 119 and a C-3, a C-47 representing what the unit flew over time, parked out in front of the headquarters building. But usually it's you got to be able to bring it home.
And makes sense.
That's where the money is. In this case, Utah's got $1.19. I would love to see Willow Grove get $1.19 home. But museums aren't cheap, and you have to be able to preserve them.
Maintenance must be significant.
Well, yeah, there's upkeep. And from a museum curation background, did I mention that I was minoring in that? You usually want a lot of these museums, the best ones keep a theme or keep a focus.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorite museums is the Air Mobility Command Museum down in Dover, Delaware. They have a focus. It's all of the aircraft that were flown by MAC, the Air Mobility Command, et cetera. So they have a narrow focus, so they pick and choose what they want to represent what their museum is. Something like Hill, they for a while there took everything, and now they're trying, and then you're going, okay, why do I have this if it doesn't represent what happened at Hill Air Force Base?
Yeah, right.
So there's a cost thing involved. So unless you're the Smithsonian, and the Smithsonian says no to a lot of people a lot of times, and they have the money to do it. Unfortunately, it happens, and hopefully somebody will rescue some of these aircraft and put them in their own museums, because you can never have enough airplane museums.
Yeah, and you hate to see some of this historic stuff get chopped up and sold for scrap metal. So,
and hence we come full circle back to our earlier story about cutting up a 727 and putting it in your backyard and living there.
Exactly.
Yeah, right? See, it all kind of makes sense here, doesn't it? See, because those people that thought we were crazy tonight? It all makes sense.
There's always a plan.
See, and I got asked last night when I was recording Extended if I had been started to gather other parts of A4s to go with the tailhook.
Oh, really?
Mike, no, I'm not going to build it. I'm build a Skyhawk in my backyard.
All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this little different episode, this kind of Airplane Geeks uncut episode. We'll hopefully return with our guest next episode, but want to thank you all for listening, for sure. We want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron, Steve Vischer. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. And Peter Johnson. You can find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, gentlemen, let's tell our listeners where they can find all of us online. David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
I probably will be shoveling snow. I'm sorry. I'm going to talk about the weather.
No worries.
You can find me at DM Vanderhoof on Twitter. I am in the process of trying to get my blog back online, so at whatjustflewby.com. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with Max Flight. I don't know who he is, talking about those drone thingies on the UAVDigest.com.
Very good. And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, they find us at Jetwine on Twitter and jetwine.com on the blog and, of course, at the Aviation Minute. But the only way you'd find the Aviation Minute right now is to go back to Jetwine. But it's going to have, thank you to a listener, it's going to have its own feed here pretty soon. So you'll be able to find me at the Aviation Minute, too. But I want to comment about the drones thing.
Yeah.
I thought those were the things you put on your cereal in the morning when you needed more fiber. Aren't those drones? No? Okay.
No. Is that what we're supposed to be talking about Fridays, David?
Fiber?
Yeah, actually, yeah, you're right. Rice Krispie treats.
Okay.
Snap, crackle, and pop.
All right. Is that it for you, Rob?
Oh, man, that's it.
That's it. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google+ and Twitter. Also, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also, the PAXX podcast that I co-host with the amazing Mary Kirby. You can find that at runwaygirlnetwork.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. They'll have links to the sites that we mentioned, also the ones that our listeners send to us. You can find all that there, some photos associated with the topics that we talk about. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And you can also find us on Stitcher.com and TuneIn.com. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet, what do you have to say about that?
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, folks. And it was prunes. You got that finally, huh, David? It was prunes, not drones. And okay.
Yeah.
I guess, okay, never mind. Good night, everybody. Yeah, well, you know what I was going to say? So obviously you can cut this part out when we're done, but you know what I was trying to figure out is that I'm watching my levels here on the mixer,
yeah,
and they're popping up into the yellow here a little bit. And so I was trying to figure out how to adjust the level of the feed that is going into the mic that you're hearing. I mean, honestly, I wasn't doing anything when you heard noise before. I was just sitting here kind of listening to the show. And so what you were hearing underneath that thing that Steve did with all the noise that was on there, I was really kind of surprised. Well, anyway, the point is that I'm playing with the various and sundry inputs here, and I don't see anything that I have tried in the last 10 minutes that has changed the level of what's going out on these meters. There's, I mean, not one knob has changed that at all.
Really? That's so, kind of scary. Something's got to change it.
Yeah, I mean, so, well, here, let me try something, and then, you know, maybe it's the way I'm looking at it, but I just want to see if you notice any difference. So this is before I changed anything. Okay, did you notice any difference now?
No.
Okay. How about now?
Same. Sounds the same.
Okay. How about now?
Again, the same.
How about now?
No change.
Well, then what the Sam Hill do I have this stupid mixer for?